Okay, let's try this one. So if you think about this problem, the question is, what's the rationale for the administration of ammonium chloride? So it's very simply put, it's ion trapping. So the guy's OD'd on amphetamine. All of this is kind of typical for amphetamine. You give him some ammonium chloride, it changes the pH of the urine. You can trap the amphetamine in the urine and therefore eliminate it from the body. So how has the administration of ammonium chloride helped your patient? Remove the drug from the body or help to eliminate the agent, right? So those are pretty simple. Okay, now, if you try to apply the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation, what do you learn? And you can play with the equations all you want to, but at pH 7.4, if you had blood pH, the ratio of protonated unprotonated happens to be 10 to the 9.8, the pKa, minus the pH, 7.4, and it equals about 252. So there's 252 protonated forms of the drug in the blood relative to each unprotonated. If you change the pH of urine, or normal, say, urine pH is 6.5, you can see there's considerably more protonated in the urine. So already under normal conditions, you're going to have a movement out of the bloodstream and into the urine. But if you drop the pH of the urine to say 4.5, this ratio really bounces up. And so the whole point here is not the absolute values of the numbers. The whole point is just to show you that with this kind of thinking, you can see a rational reason for trying to treat a patient with ammonium chloride. Now, what's the problem with ammonium chloride? Like anything else you do, it's going to have some negative effects, and so you're constantly going to have to balance the positives with the negatives. Unless this guy is in a true coma or something like that, you might ask the question of, well, can we just sit him back in a dark room, quiet room, and leave him alone for a while and let his own body get rid of it rather than hitting him with some kind of deleterious agent that could affect a lot of other things? So it's a constant balance. I didn't hit you with a quiz on the Henderson-Hasselbalch because I knew everybody was freaking out about it. So, you know, the point here is that it is useful. It can be used in a scientific and rational way in terms of treating a patient that has a specific need. So it just serves as an example for that. With regard, any questions? Okay. With regard to the quiz, anybody need any answers on the quiz? Tell you what, let's self-grade. Okay. Now be honest. Grade it correctly. Number one, what was the answer? Everybody chose what one? E. Okay, I'll agree. What about number two? Okay, curves B and D have similar EC50s. Any questions on that? It could be due to a difference in metabolism, a difference in the way the body distributes the drug around it, and all kinds of things, and have absolutely nothing to do with binding. Why don't you pass those to your left, please? So what you should, if you got them both right, you should have a 4 at the top. If you had one right, you should have a 2 at the top. If you got none right, you should see me. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Huh?
Be online, maybe?
Oh, I can get you a copy, sure. Yeah. Okay. Were there any questions from last time? Yes, no, maybe so? Okay. Thank you. Okay. Yes, sir. Yes. That's one way. That's correct, too. That wouldn't be a desensitization. You'd be getting a heightened response if the downstream effectors were greater in number than the receptor and the receptor activated more than one. But if the system ever maxes out and you can continue to hit this receptor and not produce a response, then something's turned down. And it's not necessarily agonist binding to receptor. That could be that the agonist is not coming off the receptor fast enough for new agonist to activate it again. But you could also have something downstream that's limiting. And that's really just the point of it. So you can have all this drug sitting in the system and the system not do anything because something downstream can't get back to normal so that it can be activated.
So I always have associated the desensitization with receptor endopsychosis. Is that necessarily the correct view, or is it that you're not getting a response? You know, I associate desensitization with like receptor recycling and all this.
That is one mechanism that could be involved.
So it's just simply not getting a response.
But most people think of receptor desensitization as something is happening such that you can't end up with the pharmacologic response or physiologic response that you're looking for. The site of the problem can be a number of places because most of these systems aren't simple. There are always second and third messengers that are involved. This just happens to be an easy one because you end up phosphorylating the receptor. This additional protein sticks itself on the phosphorylation site, and then you can have all the drug in the world and nothing happens downstream because this bar protein is stuck onto the phosphorylated receptor. So you got to take the agonist away, you got to let the bar protein come off, you got to dephosphorylate the protein before it can activate again. So it's just a kind of a clean example of something that turns off the receptor activation process as a whole. Okay? Everybody understand that? Okay, very good. Today we're going to talk about pharmacokinetics. And every time I do this lecture, I wonder why I give so much math. So I'll probably oversimplify again. But when we think about pharmacokinetics, we're really thinking about rates. We can mathematically manipulate every one of these arrows. And of course, what's wrong with this figure? With the exception of some things, drugs can go backwards and forwards. So some of these arrows need to be bidirectional. But when we think about pharmacokinetics, we're talking about the rates for what the body does to the drug. So how does the body distribute it? How does it metabolize it? How does it excrete it? In some kind of a quantifiable way. And so when we look at things, Our definition of absorption is very simple. What is it? You should remember. Drug in blood. Okay? So it doesn't matter where it's applied, it has to get into the bloodstream in order to be absorbed. So when we think of absorption, it's getting the drug into the bloodstream. So here we are in the systemic circulation. When we think of distribution, it's very simple as well. Where does the drug go? There's some drugs, ethanol being one, that distribute in total body water. It's a nice, small, lipophilic substance. It crosses membranes at will. It goes everywhere. Then you've got other drugs that never leave the bloodstream, except for an itty-bitty little bit. But that's all that's needed to get to the active site to do whatever that drug's designed to do. So distribution, then, is where does that drug go throughout the body? When we think of the step of elimination, we think of how's the body trying to get rid of it. But elimination can be multiple steps. You can get rid of a drug in one sense by metabolizing it and making it inactive. So while the drug may physically still be in the body, it's biologically inactive. So we think it's been taken out of the equation, or it's been eliminated. And then the purist would say, wait, the drug's still there, it's just inactive. You don't eliminate it until you excrete it. And then you can think of various ways to get something out of the body. So urine, feces, sweat, hair, nails, exhalation. So there are a lot of different ways that one could excrete drugs. And the two primary ones that we're going to focus on through most of the course are going to be urinary and fecal elimination. This word metabolism. Some people think that biotransformation is a better term. Metabolism could mean intermediary metabolism. You know how glucose gets broken down in the Krebs cycle and all that stuff. So when we're talking about drugs or foreign substances that are getting into the body, some people say, well, biotransformation would be a better term. Throughout this course, and really within your books, whenever you see the word metabolism, it's synonymous to biotransformation. We're going to talk about next time specific enzymes that do specific kinds of reactions to various structures of drugs. All right. Yes, sir. Well, no, it's still metabolism, but it's not eliminating it because it's activating it. So biotransformation can activate drugs. You're right. But most people think of it this way just because it's a little more convenient. But as we go through the course, you'll be exposed to a lot of prodrugs that are activated by the cytochrome P450 system in particular to active agents. Okay. So in therapy, what's the real goal? Well, you're trying to get some kind of a clinical response. So you really want to maximize efficacy. You want to maximize the effect that you desire, while at the same time trying to minimize toxicity. And the important thing to remember in pharmacology is that very few drugs have a single action. So you're constantly balancing the effect that you want with the toxicity that you may get. Probably one of the worst classes of drugs to think about in this regard are your antipsychotic agents. The phenothiazines and non-phenothiazine type derivatives, what do? They're dopamine receptor blockers, they're alpha receptor blockers, they're muscarinic receptor blockers, among a few other things. What do dopamine receptor blockers do? Well, there's about a half dozen things you'll learn. What do alpha blockers do? There's about a half dozen things you're going to learn. What do muscarinic receptors do? You block those, seven or eight things that they do. So what you realize very, very quickly is that with some drugs, you've got a very delicate balance here. Other drugs may be less dirty. In other words, you can get a nice therapeutic effect without having tremendous toxicity to worry about. But at least pharmacokinetically, all of these events can be described, and you're looking for a balance of trying to get enough drug really to the site of action to produce some kind of a clinical effect with minimal toxicity. Okay. When you look at pharmacokinetic data in the literature, there's really a caveat that you have to think about. The standard dose of the drug that comes packaged was determined in a study using healthy volunteers or patients that have some disease, but they have essentially normal ability to handle the drug. So in other words, they're not in renal failure, they don't have compromised liver function and things of that nature. So they're healthy enough to take this drug and basically deal with it just like a healthy human person would. So the numbers that you see in the literature are all dealing with, you know, kind of a healthy cohort. And then oftentimes, though, the drug will be prescribed and given to someone who has compromises in other areas of function. And so as we go through this, we're going to talk about what happens if you have a drug that's eliminated through the urine and urinary functions reduced by 50%. What happens if a drug is cleared by the liver, it's metabolized in the liver, and liver function is essentially gone because they're riddled with tumor or sclerosis for that matter. So you can manipulate the equation to back calculate an appropriate dose or a safer dose for those kinds of patients. So just remember that the numbers that people often will publish and throw at you are generated with, if you will, healthy patients and volunteers. When we think of absorption, what do you think is the primary or fastest route of absorption? IV. So it's 100% of drug in and it's instantaneous. But then you think of other ways of getting drugs in the body. You can think of intramuscular injections, subcutaneous injections. You can talk about oral, buccal, sublingual, rectal, inhalational, topical. What's left? I guess dermal if you want to split topical because it could be eye. I just gave you a whole list. I don't know if you remember the list, but I basically went from fastest to slowest. And so if you want the list again, IV, IM, sub-Q, oral, buccal, sublingual, rectal, inhalational, topical, and dermal. Yes, sir?
Surprisingly, inhalation is so far down on the list.
It depends on two other issues. It depends on how soluble the compound is in the surfactant layer, and it also depends on the respiration rate. You may be blowing it out as fast as you're pulling it in, and it doesn't have time to interact. Yes, sir? They're kind of, it's always on the right-hand side of oral, but they're close. So if you had greater than symbols, maybe you would put oral, sublingual, rectal all together because they're fairly similar. And you'd probably put inhalation in kind of with that group too. And then way down here, you'd have your dermal. Okay. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm confused about that too, because if you give somebody nitro sublingual, does it take like 20 seconds? If you take
less.
Advil, it's like 20 minutes, right?
You can't compare one drug to the other.
Well,
okay. Don't get confused here. We're not worrying about absolutes. It's kind of a generalization. IV's fastest and complete, instantaneous, everything gets in. You got all this stuff in the middle that's kind of variable, and then way down near over there is dermal. It's the slowest. But guess what? If it can be absorbed across the skin and you can put that in a dermal patch and the patient can wear the patch for a week and that they only have to remember on Sunday to pull the patch off and put the new one on, you got a great way to get the drug into the patient and have high patient compliance. If you got to remember to take a pill three times a day, you know, that middle pill gets forgotten a lot. So it's the relativities of rates of absorption that are important and not necessarily the absolutes. What controls distribution? What kind of factors do you think would control distribution? Size, polarity, okay. I'm sorry? Yep. Could be. Depends how lipid-soluble it is. Stuff goes in the brain pretty fast if it's lipid-soluble. So, solubility of the drug in the tissue. Organ size, we've already talked about. There's something else that has to do with kind of, how does the drug get to tissues in the bloodstream? So what might be important? Perfusion of the organ. So if you were a good engineer, you could actually string together mass balance equations that had to do with the concentration in the tissue and the blood flow to the tissue, and come up with a nice round number for how stuff gets where it gets. We're not going to do that. So just recognize that distribution is a function of the properties of the drug itself, organ size, blood flow to the organ, differential solubilities in tissues, bindings, and so forth. When we think about metabolism or biotransformation, we've already mentioned it. You can activate or inactivate the drug. Usually we often talk about biotransformation having the primary effect to inactivate the drug and make it more water soluble. If it's more water soluble, what do you think that has to do with excretion? It's going to enhance its excretion. Okay. When we think of elimination, we often talk about two different kinds of elimination. We can talk about first order elimination. We could talk about zero order elimination. Zero order is the simplest. Ethanol, Phenytoin are two examples of drugs that are eliminated through zero-order elimination. And what do you notice? The amount eliminated per unit time is identical. Doesn't matter what the plasma concentration is, but the elimination rate stays constant. So in this case, we've got 2.5 units of whatever the agent is, let's just say ethanol, being eliminated per hour. So zero order, real simple. Elimination rate constant, same amount eliminated per unit time. Plasma concentration, not important. Most drugs, though, obey first order elimination kinetics, where we look at something like this, where you can see that it is plasma concentration dependent. The elimination rate is changing with time, and it is a function of the plasma concentration. So if you think of this in terms of kind of like half-lives, at this point you got rid of 5 units per hour. Well, that means you had less in there to begin with, so the next hour you're going to have less to get rid of. So you got rid of 5, now you're getting rid of 2.5. Another half-life later, you're going to get rid of the half of that. So now you're down to the 1.25, and it just continues. 0.625, and so forth. So with first-order elimination, it is plasma concentration dependent. So the elimination rate is a function of the plasma concentration. So in terms of examples, pick a drug and you're probably first order. So what are the exceptions? Ethanol, phenytoin. You guys know what phenytoin is? Phenytoin, it can be used in grand mal seizures, and it also can be used as an antiarrhythmic in the treatment of digitalis toxicity. Or digoxin toxicity. So, there's a third one. Let's see, ethanol, phenytoin, and aspirin, acetyl salicylic acid. So, most of the time, this is the way you got to think. Think in terms of just half-lives. Yes, ma'am. They just are. And I cannot offer an explanation. Okay? So is that clear? Good. Now, pharmacokineticists often get into looking at how things are removed from the bloodstream. And most drugs that we deal with fit what's called a two-compartment model. And basically what that means is that the drug gets into the bloodstream, that's compartment number one, and then it distributes to tissues, and that would be compartment number two. So if all you did was take a brand new drug, inject it in somebody, and take blood at various time points, you would end up with a curve, and it would look like this. So we got serum concentration as a function of time. In a two-compartment model, you have a biphasic curve where there is a very rapid distribution phase, meaning that the concentration of the drug in the blood changes very, very rapidly. And then it seems to change and become much slower. And that becomes this elimination phase. So what we have then is mathematically, you can calculate a half-life for distribution by just drawing a straight line through these couple of points here. You can calculate a half-life for the elimination phase. And there's actually a bunch of other stuff you can calculate too, but the only one that's relevant to you guys, unless you become a pharmacokineticist and into clinical pharm, is going to be half-life. So let's take, for example, thiopental. Anybody know what thiopental is? Okay, it's an ultra-short-acting barbiturate, commonly called truth serum. You inject thiopental. Let's say you give it IV, so at time zero, you got all of it in. Within minutes, the distribution phase will drop, and then it'll flatten out. You don't really see CNS effects until you begin to get the drug distributed into the CNS, and you begin to see the flipping from the distribution phase into the elimination phase. But at that time, that's kind of when you want to ask the people what you want to know. Okay? Thiopental distributes very, very quickly. It's ultra short acting because it diffuses out of the brain as fast as it goes in. So it doesn't stick around long enough to do much. So if you think of thiopental, you may have an onset of action, say, in 5 minutes, and by 20 minutes, it's over. In contrast, you could have another one, phenobarbital. Phenobarbital, which has an onset of action of about an hour and a half-life of 8 to 10 hours. So it's the same class of drugs, it's a barbiturate, but very, very different in its pharmacokinetic properties. And so what you would see with phenobarbital then is a much slower distribution phase before it launched into its elimination phase. So depending on this curve then, you can learn a lot about the drug. The primary things to remember is that in a two-compartment model, the two compartments are blood and the tissues. And so they're taking into account the distribution. Yes, sir. Yeah.
So if it was first order, would it be more well after the initial drop-off?
Wait a minute, say that again.
If it was a first order elimination, would it be more well after the initial distribution?
This is a first order equation.
First order?
Yeah. So you've got this part and you got this part. So you got a bypass.
Alright, that's it.
Okay. If you did have a pure monophasic curve, you wouldn't have this part of it. It would basically be linear back to time zero.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Two-compartment model, early distribution phase followed by a slow elimination phase. What's the difference with a single-compartment model? All the drug is in the bloodstream, and elimination begins with entry into the compartment. So basically, you're on just this single elimination phase, and so if you were to look at a blood concentration versus time curve, you would just have a single straight line and not a biphasic curve. Okay. Often, in this particular model, the distribution phase is called the alpha phase. The elimination phase is called the beta phase. And you will see in the literature that the beta half-life which is the one you're most concerned with, the elimination half-life is some value. And so they may refer to this particular half-life as the beta half-life, T1 half beta is showing here. There would be a T1 half alpha up here as well. So if they refer to alpha and beta half-lives, the elimination half-life that you're most interested in is going to be the beta phase half-life. All right. There are a couple other terms that you need to think about. The first one is called the volume of distribution. What is it? It's really a hypothetical value. So you could have a value of the volume that the drug would occupy for a given plasma concentration. So if you look at the equation, you got the amount of drug in the body divided by the plasma concentration. So it's fairly simple to calculate, but sometimes it gives you numbers that will kind of mess with your mind a little bit. So when you think of a 70 kilogram man or woman, what would their volume be? 70 liters, okay. Ethanol has a volume of distribution of about 300,000 liters. Okay, that doesn't necessarily compute. How can you have more volume than you can have? And it's just a function of how the drug can distribute into every other tissue, and it means that the amount in the plasma is very, very low for the amount of drug that was given. That's how you can get a big number. So that's why I say it's kind of a hypothetical value. It's not an actual factual, meaningful number. But the number can be meaningful, though, in the sense that if you've got drugs that have volumes of distribution, let's say, of 100 to 500, your immediate thought should be it's in the bloodstream. If you've got values from 500 to 1,000, you can say, well, it's clearly getting out of the bloodstream. It's probably in a particular tissue. But then when you get these huge numbers, you know it's going more in one place. So the volume of distribution can be confusing in that the number is not scientifically rational in your mind. There's no way that a human being could have that many liters. The units of volume of distribution are volume units. And so if you're dealing with milligrams of drug and you've got plasma concentrations in milligrams per milliliter, then your units are going to be in milliliters. If you want milligrams of drug and milligrams per liter, then the units would be liters. So watch your unit conversions if you're doing calculations. So that's volume of distribution. Hypothetical value of how much volume the drug would occupy given its plasma concentration. The second term that we use a lot is clearance. Clearance is the volume from which a drug is removed in a specified time. Most people, when they want to think of clearance, think about how much drug is removed. That's not what clearance is. Clearance is the volume cleansed of the drug, if you will. So you think, well, that's a tad backwards, but that's the way it is. Clearance, volume from which a drug is removed in a specified time. You can see from the equation, it's the rate of elimination of the drug divided by the plasma concentration. So the units are going to be volume per time. So if you remember the units, you'll remember that the clearance is a volume term. So in first order elimination, clearance is constant, And the rate of elimination is dependent on CP, which is the plasma concentration. The last equation on that page simply is there to show you that clearance can be a function of what happens in individual organs. So CL, meaning the total clearance, is a function of liver or hepatic clearance plus renal, kidney clearance, plus any other organ that's involved in the clearance process. And so if you know that renal elimination is compromised, then CL kidney is going to be less than in a normal patient. If you know that hepatic clearance is compromised, then that term would be less. Consequently, total would be less. Okay. In first order elimination, skip number three. Let's just talk about half-life. Half-life is the other term that gets used quite a bit in pharmacokinetic discussions and in the material that you're going to see. Half-life, the time required to change the amount of drug in the body by half. Okay. So T1 half, you can calculate it. It's 0.693 times the volume of distribution divided by clearance. And half-life, imagine that, has the units of time. So again, once you see the units should match the term you're trying to measure. Half-lives vary tremendously from drug to drug. Half-lives also vary between individuals on the same drug. So if we took this class, gave everybody the same drug, took out blood at various time points, and calculated individual half-lives, we would see a pretty large range. So it depends on drug, depends on patient, and it also decreases with age. So as people get into their geriatric years, half-lives tend to become, what do you think? Longer. So it takes longer to get rid of half of the drug. They don't metabolize as quickly, they don't excrete as quickly. So the half-life may go from 10 hours to 12 hours to 14 hours. Everybody clear with that? I see some frowns. That's just because you're reminding me it's time to take a break. The last figure we'll look at before we take a break is in the middle of the page. Notice two curves. One is an accumulation curve. So you got plasma concentration as a function of time in terms of half-life. How long does it take when you start a new drug to get to the steady state plasma concentration? These are half-lives down here. So how long did it take to get to steady state? You know what steady state is? So basically, up here, where things are flat, where very little change makes any difference. So to get to steady state, we usually talk 4 to 5 half-lives as a general rule. With this figure, you might say 0.6. So if you're starting a patient on a drug, and you know that the drug has a half-life of 24 hours, how long is it going to take before you know that the drug concentration is pretty much where it's going to stay with that patient? So 5-6 days. So if you're looking at effect, let's say you're giving them an anti-hypertensive med, And let's say you start them on it, and 2 days later, you want to discern if their blood pressure is going down and if the medicine is working. Is that going to be valid? Not really. You're going to need to wait until you're at steady state in terms of the drug in the plasma, and then you can begin to ask the question of, am I getting the efficacy that I want? So, knowing the accumulation rate, the half-life for accumulation, the half-life's about the same, then you can discern when's the best time to measure things. The flip side of that is, the drug's not working, or the patient's exhibiting toxicity to it that you don't want to deal with. How long do you have to wait to get the drug out of the system before you put a new drug in? The rule of thumb's about the same, 4, 5, you know, 6 half-lives, and you're basically down to asymptotic condition. So, that number, let's just say 5 half-lives, is important. It takes 5 half-lives to get the steady state plasma concentrations on new dosing. It takes 5 half-lives to get rid of the drug. It's not uncommon, especially when dealing with mental illness, to start a patient on a drug and have to wait 4 or 5 weeks before you know if it's effective. And then you find out it's not doing the patient a whole lot of good. You really need to wait those 5, 6 half-lives to get that old drug out before you go and add another drug, because then you may be dealing with a mess that you don't want to deal with. So this is worth remembering. Okay? Everybody clear? Ready for a break? Okay.